Luister naar Studio Den Haag als je wilt weten of het gaat lukken om een kabinet met de PVV van Geert Wilders te vormen. We vertellen je alles over de langslepende kabinetsformatie, over wat de opvallendste momenten zijn in de Tweede Kamerdebatten en belangrijker wat er wordt gezegd als de microfoons uitstaan, in de wandelgangen dus. Je vindt Studio Den Haag in je favoriete podcast-app.
BNR Nieuwsradio. The Big Five. Art Rooijakkers.
Goedemorgen, fijn dat je luistert naar BNR's Big Five. De Britten zijn nu meer dan 100 dagen uit de EU. Tijd om de balans op te maken. Wat merken wij en de Britten nou van Brexit in ons dagelijks leven? Hoeveel is er uitgekomen van al die verwachte doemscenario's? Dat bespreken we vandaag met een speciale gast. Een man die in het Brexit-proces steeds dicht bij het vuur heeft gezeten en menig verhit debat in het Britse lagerhuis heeft geleid. Voormalig Speaker of the House of Commons en hoogleraar politicologie aan de Royal Holloway University of London, John Bercow. Good morning, Mr. Bercow. We will do this interview in English, of course. Good morning.
Well, I'm very relieved to hear it. Good morning to you. It's a pleasure to appear on your program.
I'm sure all of our listeners will instantly recognize you when I play the following clip.
Order! I know what I'm doing. Order! 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 There's no good people shouting. There will be an opportunity for other points of order, but the Prime Minister must and will be heard. Order!
Yeah.
Order!
Order. You're world famous for this word, of course. Do you know how often you used the word during your work as a speaker?
Yes, 14,000 times.
Yeah, exactly, Art, yeah.
In 10 years and 4 months that I served as speaker. I didn't know that myself, no. But somebody inquired or researched it, and that was the answer, that those words, order or order, order, were uttered 14,000 times.
So there has been a British scientist who has been counting the times you have spoken the word order.
Well, a scientist, a mathematician, or maybe just an interested member of the public. I'm not quite sure who it was.
No.
But that is the straight answer to your question. Politicians are always accused, Art, of not giving straight answers. So I've started this interview, I hope, as I mean to go on, by giving you a straight answer to your very fair question.
Well, thank you for that. Before we go on, I would like to ask you whether three short questions, I'm sorry, that you only may answer by yes or no. You may elaborate on the answers later in the show. This is how we start the show here. The first is, there's still a chance the UK will fall apart over Brexit.
Yes.
The second, there's absolutely nothing positive coming out of Brexit for the UK.
Yes, that is correct. There is nothing positive coming out of it.
And the third one, I have no regrets on how I handled the Brexit debates as a speaker.
Correct. I have no regrets.
Okay. Three times correct, three times yes. We will we will talk about this later. First, already in 2019, you labeled Brexit as, and I quote, the biggest post-war foreign policy mistake. How do you feel about it now? Now we're almost 5 months after the fact.
Well, I stand by the view that I expressed, you're quite right, in 2019. I specifically made that observation, and in either those words or very similar words, on the 4th of November 2019. I mentioned that, Art, because my last day in the chair as Speaker was the 31st of October, and a new Speaker was elected on the 4th of November 2019, and on that occasion, on that day, I gave an interview to the Foreign Press Association in which I said that Brexit was the most colossal foreign policy blunder of the post-war period. I didn't express views about Brexit as Speaker. I expressed views about procedure, about the handling of the matter by Parliament, about the rights of MPs, and how the government should behave in its dealings and interactions with Parliament, but I didn't express a view for or against Brexit from the chair. I did vote against Brexit in the referendum, which as a citizen I had every right to do, and then, as I say, when I left office within days, I did say that I thought it was the most colossal foreign policy blunder of the post-war period. And I say that because it struck me then, and it strikes me now, as an act of national self-harm by the United Kingdom.
National self-harm?
My reasoning is, yes, in other words, we have inflicted damage upon ourselves. And I say that because I think really there are two very powerful reasons why it would have been better for the UK to stay in the European Union. First, it's a power block, and we're in a world of power blocks. Mm-hmm. And it would have made sense for a small, proud, determined, admirable, but medium-sized European power called mm-hmm. the UK to remain as a part of that power block where it would exert greater influence and hold greater sway than just acting on its own. That's the first point. And the second point is that the European Union is a trade bloc and a very important trade bloc at that. And it seemed to me to make more sense to be part of that trade bloc than to be excluded, or indeed, to go back to this point about self-harm, willfully to exclude ourselves from it. Mm-hmm. That seemed to me to be a terrible mistake. Now, if you ask me a few months on how I feel about it, you won't be surprised to know that my view hasn't changed.
No.
I think it is going to be damaging to the UK in terms both of trade and commerce and of inferior and declining political influence.
Yes.
So all in all, I think it's a very bad thing. I accept, for the avoidance of doubt and so that your listeners are clear, that the government has a right to proceed with Brexit
uh-huh.
because they managed to persuade Parliament to have an election in December 2019, and Boris Johnson and his party, the Conservative Party, won that election. So, yes, they've got a right to go ahead, but you would think me a very strange person if I suddenly said, well, not only have they got a right to go ahead,
yeah.
but I think they're absolutely right on the issue.
Yeah.
I think they've got a right to go ahead, but they're absolutely wrong on the issue. And I think the UK will be shriveled, diminished, poorer, and less influential as a result.
Yeah. The arguments you give for this are pretty rational. You talk about blocks, about power blocks in the world. My opinion, or not my opinion, my view was, and a lot of views was, that Brexit was, people voted for Brexit because of a sentiment. They wanted control back. So this is what
yes.
wasn't a rational choice maybe, but more emotional maybe.
Well, I rather agree with you. I think it was an emotional choice. Now, of course, there is a role for emotion and feeling and sentiment in politics. And, you know, you cannot simply have a referendum and then prescribe on what basis people vote. People are entitled to vote on whatever basis they choose. But I think it's a reasonable observation for me to make that very, very, very large numbers of voters across the United Kingdom did not vote on Brexit, did not vote on the question of whether we should stay in or depart from the European Union
mm-hmm.
on the strength of a detailed understanding of the operation of the customs union or the single market. Why? Well, because most people wouldn't consider themselves to be experts
yeah.
on the matter of the operation of the customs union or the single market. They wouldn't, moreover, be necessarily particularly conscious of or closely familiar with the detailed policies of the European Union to which the United Kingdom had been signed up. No, people were making an overall judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Did they think that it was better economically or politically, or both, to be part of this bloc, or did they want to be out of it? And insofar as they wanted to be out of it, and they did by a small majority,
yep.
I think you're right that they wanted to be out because they wanted to use that slogan to take back control.
Exactly. So they voted against their own interests in a way, maybe, in
well,
your opinion.
They did vote against their own interests because I don't think actually we have taken back control. There is a difference, if you like, Art, between formal power and practical or meaningful power. In formal terms, we've taken back control in the sense that we're not subject to European lawmaking. That is true. But the reality is that all governments around the world have to operate within the context of an interdependent world
mm-hmm.
where you can't just do exactly as you like without any consequences. You have to recognize that there are other countries and groups of countries by whose actions you are affected, and whom you can affect by your actions. Now, we are one country, mm-hmm. and we can make a decision to leave the European Union, but we can't change the realities of the global marketplace, the need to trade, to sell our goods, to make profit, to create wealth, to increase jobs, and so on. Mm-hmm. And none of those things, I'm afraid, is going to happen as a result of Brexit. So this theory about taking back control is about sovereignty, the right of the UK Parliament to make decisions. Well, yes, we can make decisions about our own laws, it is true, but insofar as our fortunes are affected massively, dictated really by trade, our capacity to earn our living in the world, that is about our ties with other countries, our ability to sell to buy from, to trade with other countries. Now, trading with the European Union is now going to be more burdensome, more bureaucratic, more subject to bottlenecks than it was before.
But still,
and in many cases, it's going to be more expensive than it was before. The deal we have is a skeleton, threadbare, minimalist deal.
Yeah.
And it's a deal, as you know, on goods. Mm-hmm. The whole question of services, which is a huge part of the British economy, is not dealt with by the agreement between the UK and the European Union. And I think that we got a last-minute deal of a poor quality, and it was nothing like as good as the deal we had before. The other point I just very briefly mentioned to you is when you say you think people voted out, perhaps in the UK out of sentiment, and I said I agreed with you, people wanted to take back control, there is no doubt that a very important part of the explanation for the referendum decision was that a lot of people objected to migration to the UK. In my opinion, and it is just my opinion, that motivation was wrong. I believe that migration has been very good for the United Kingdom, and we've been able to attract and retain some of the best talent from around the world. As a result of coming out of the European Union, we're not now subject to the free movement policy, it is true, but migration from the rest of the world is still a fact, and we have to reckon with that, and we have to craft a policy that will suit UK PLC. And it is both simplistic
UK
and
PLC?
Misguided. UK as a business. UK as a business.
I understand.
UK PLC means UK public limited company, if you like, UK viewed economically. And my view is that it's in our interests to be able to attract and retain and nurture and hone the best talent in this country. And that means that we have to take people from elsewhere. And that's not just true commercially. It's true in, for example, higher education. We're going to find it more difficult to attract and retain the best academics from across Europe now that, you know, it is very much more difficult for them to come to the UK. That seems to me to be a loss. So you've got this theory, I put it to your viewers, your listeners rather, that we've got this theory that we're taking back control, but actually we're going to have less influence and we're going to earn less and be less effective in our dealings with Europe and with countries across the globe. So that seems to me completely at variance,
a complete opposite
conflict with what it's purported to be achieved by the Brexiteers.
The Big Five. Art Rooijakkers.
Fijn dat je luistert naar BNR's Big Five. Deze week vijf kopstukken uit de wereld van Brexit in perspectief. Mijn gast vandaag is niemand minder dan de voormalige speaker van het Britse lagerhuis, Mr. John Bercow. Daarom doen we dit interview natuurlijk in het Engels. Mr. Bercow, we've been talking about Brexit and the negative effects. But there must also be something good coming from Brexit. If we look at, for instance, the autonomous way Boris Johnson has handled the mass vaccination program, for example, that wouldn't have been possible being part of the EU.
Well, I think the vaccination program has been a great success, and I'm ready to acknowledge that. And it's the first piece of good news during this otherwise traumatic and damaging and rather frightening year. But I suppose what I would say to you about that is that although it's a very good thing, it's a tribute to scientists and it's a tribute to the National Health Service. In other words, it is a scientific discovery of a vaccine that has made progress possible, and with no disrespect to the Right Honourable Gentleman, Prime Minister Boris Alexander de Pfeffel Johnson, yes. That's got nothing to do with him.
Uh-huh.
Last time I looked, he wasn't a scientist.
No, exactly.
I don't think he had anything to do with the discovery of the vaccine.
But here at the mainland, at the continent, we're all pretty jealous of the UK, of the vaccination speed in the UK. And we here in the Netherlands seem to think that that is a factor because of the Brexit.
Yes, I don't see that it's related to Brexit. I must say, I just think it's a tribute to scientific ingenuity.
Mm-hmm.
And to effective rollout, and the vaccine has been very successfully rolled out, and that's a wonderful thing. More than 30 million people in this country have now been vaccinated, and there is good progress. And yes, the government does have a roadmap out of the coronavirus, the pandemic, and to try to get the economy and society moving again. And I welcome that, but I don't think that you should fall for the idea that this is an accomplishment of or a byproduct from Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
It is just the government trying to react as best it can to events. In fact, the government was very slow in the first instance. We were very late going into lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
And then the government had a very foolhardy and misguided view that it would be possible to deal with this matter very quickly. The Prime Minister famously said that he thought we would be able to get on top of the virus within 12 weeks. Well, that was absolutely detached from reality. There was no validity in that thesis at all. It's taken a great deal longer. We're now 13 months on.
Yeah.
We are making progress, and I'm very happy, Art, to acknowledge progress, and some ministers have had a better pandemic, if you like, than others. Some ministers have performed more.
But if you allow me, Mr. Burko, if you allow me, I mean, because of Brexit, the British have been more working solo, so the vaccination campaign could have been has been more effective, maybe, because of Brexit. Here in the Netherlands, we have to deal with the other European countries, we have to deal with the European Medical Agency, and that slowed things down.
Well, that may very well be. That may very well be. I mean, certainly there has been a capacity to get on with it in this country,
mm-hmm.
and after a very slow start and all sorts of false and unrealistic hopes, great progress has been made. And in the end, you have to make a judgment about two things. Do you think, on the whole, the progress on the rollout of the vaccine and the route out of coronavirus is mainly down to the politicians, or is it mainly down to the professionals? I think it has been driven by the professionals, by mm-hmm. the scientists, by the National Health Service, and to some extent by sheer public fury about the mess into which we got ourselves, not least by being complacent and slow 13 months ago, and that was the fault of the government. And I think the other thing you have to consider is the simple question, if you're looking at a cost-benefit calculus, do the costs of Brexit, on the whole, outweigh the benefits, or do the benefits outweigh the costs? And in my opinion, the costs very, very, very greatly outweigh the benefits. I don't come at it myself, Art, from the vantage point of someone who says everything about the European Union is marvellous, that it can't be reformed, that it doesn't need to improve. I don't think that. I think it's often slow and sclerotic and slothful.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it could be much sharper in appreciating the need for competitiveness and a lighter touch.
Yeah.
It could be less bureaucratic and so on. But overall, I think the issue is making a hard-headed calculation about the UK's national interest. So in my case, I totally respect the fact that there are some people in Britain and a lot more in continental Europe who have a kind of philosophical or ideological attachment to the idea of European unity.
Did you say that it's more irrational?
I wouldn't want to use the term irrational, but I would say that it is motivated by a certain sort of European romanticism, if you like, a notion that we should all join together and be together because of the beauty of being together.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I don't have any sort of ideological or philosophical belief in the notion of European integration. It's not that I want to see some wonderful symmetrical hold called the European Union. It's that I've looked at the situation as a pragmatic Brit, and I've asked myself, are we on the whole better off in the Union or worse off? And my view is that being part of a big market of 500 million plus consumers made sense. It's the biggest market and it's on our doorstep and we ought to be part of it. Yeah. And secondly, in an age in which some of the Brexiteers need to be reminded, Britannia does not rule the waves. We are not in charge of an empire. We can't dictate what other countries do, and quite rightly so. We've got to trade our way in the world, and we've got to rely on soft power, our diplomatic skill, our negotiating armoury, to try to achieve progress on things like the fight against identity theft, against the drug trade.
Yeah, so you need the European Union for that. I mean, you made this point earlier on the show and also when you stepped down as a speaker, but even during your time as speaker, your impartiality was in question at some point during the Brexit process. There was even discussion about a car sticker. Let's listen.
We've all noticed in recent months a sticker in your car making derogatory comments about Brexit. No, this is a serious point about partiality. Have you driven that car with the sticker there?
That sticker on the subject of Brexit happens to be affixed to or in the windscreen of my wife's car. She is entitled to her views. That sticker is not mine, and that's the end of it.
It says something about the debate being so heated, or not.
It does say something about the debate being so heated, and you quite fairly quote the question that was put to me on a supposed point of order by a Conservative Member of Parliament who was a Brexiteer, and you quote some of my reply. I did actually say also, and I'm sure the Honourable Gentleman isn't suggesting for one moment that a wife is somehow the property or chattel of her husband.
Yeah.
And that did actually get considerable cheers across the House.
Uh-huh.
So I don't blame you for not quoting that. You gave the short version.
Yeah.
But yes, the exchanges were very heated. But I do actually stand by my point. My wife is a strong opponent of Brexit.
Yeah.
She has her own car and she had that sticker in it.
Yeah.
Now, did it lead to a minor controversy, particularly out in what I call the tabloid press, that is to say the Daily Mail and elsewhere? It did. And that particular Conservative MP picked up on it and challenged me about it. But my attitude was and remains that, yes, as Speaker, I had to be impartial in the chair and in making rulings about motions and amendments and so on. And I believe I was.
It wasn't difficult to be impartial during all those procedures?
Not really, because it's a matter of duty.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of obligation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of doing what's right. And the truth is actually, Art, that when the Brexiteers were in the minority on their own side, on the Conservative side. In fact, they weren't even known then as Brexiteers. They were known as Eurosceptics.
Yeah.
I regularly granted them opportunities in the form of things we call urgent questions in Parliament to probe and question and scrutinise government ministers, including the Prime Minister, about European policy. And Bill Cash and Bernard Jenkin and others, Eurosceptics in the British Conservative Party, weren't complaining then when I was granting them their opportunities. But what they didn't like was after the referendum, they wanted to close the debate down. And when other people from their party who were anti-Brexit or wanted a much softer Brexit, I'm talking about people like Oliver Letwin, Dominic Grieve and Anna Soubry and Justine Greening and David Gawke and so on, when people like that started wanting to express their views and I gave them their opportunity because I thought it was right to do so,
then their opinion shifted.
The Brexiteers started screaming and grumbling and moaning. And I said, well, there's an old expression in Britain, I don't know if it's familiar to people in Holland, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. In other words, what was right to do by them. Uh-huh. It was right to do by the other side of the argument. So my argument is that, yes, if you ask me what my private view is, I admit that my private view was against Brexit. But in the chair, on Brexit...
You were impartial.
As on same-sex marriage and on all sorts of other controversial issues, I was always impartial. I always tried to give every voice the chance to be heard.
Yeah. Okay, we will continue in a few minutes. And after the break, I would like to know whether you think Boris Johnson is what the UK needs right now. We zijn er zo weer met Mr. Speaker John Burke.
BNR Nieuwsradio. The Big Five. Art Rooijakkers.
Welkom bij het tweede halfuur van BNR's Big Five. Deze week vijf kopstukken uit de wereld van Brexit in perspectief. Vandaag de gast John Bercow, voormalig speaker van het Britse Lagerhuis. En daarom voeren wij dit gesprek in het Engels. Mr. Bercow, you were speaker in the House of Commons for 10 years. The longest serving speaker since World War II. And this is what former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn said about you when you announced you were stepping down.
But Mr. Speaker, in your role as speaker, you've totally changed the way in which the job has been done. You've reached out to people across the whole country. You've visited schools. You've visited factories. You've visited offices. You've talked to people about the role of Parliament and democracy. This Parliament is the stronger for your being Speaker. Our democracy is the stronger for your being the Speaker. And whatever you do when you finally step down from Parliament, you do so with the thanks of a very large number of people. And as one that has made the role of Speaker in the House more powerful, not less powerful, I welcome that.
These were warm words from Jeremy Corbyn, the former Labour leader. Does it hit the nail on the head?
Well, it's for others to judge whether I was a successful speaker, Art. I always said throughout my speakership in speeches around the country to schools and universities and voluntary organisations that no person can be judge in his or her own cause. That is to say, it's up to other people to decide whether they think I was good at my job. I suppose the only point I would make really is, first of all, I did keep getting elected and re-elected, and I am, as things stand, as you rightly pointed out a moment ago, the longest serving speaker of the post-war period. And secondly, I did try to do what Jeremy Corbyn described that day in the chamber. I tried to innovate and reform within the chamber to give MPs more chance to question, to probe, to scrutinise, to challenge, to contradict, sometimes to expose errors of omission or commission of the government of the day. I tried to make the place more family-friendly and to modernise it by introducing a nursery in Parliament and an education centre that can be visited by huge numbers of young people across the country. It's a digital facility which tells the story of how British democracy evolved. I tried to make it more diverse with appointments of women and BAME representatives to senior positions. I don't know if you understand me when I say that traditionally the British Parliament has been dominated by white, male, upper middle class or even upper class people.
Yeah.
And I wanted to make it more, if you like, of a mirror image, more representative of the UK.
Is it fair to say that you tried to...
I went around the country and talked to people and was questioned by people. I listened to people in a way that speakers didn't used to do.
Now, is it fair to say you've tried to close the gap between citizens and politics? That was, I think, a part of your mission. And now the vote for leaving the EU and the Brexit referendum made the sentiment of the citizens not feeling heard by the government very clear.
Well, I did try to break down the barrier between representatives and the represented. Yes, I wanted to demythologize, if you like, and demystify Parliament. I remember at an early stage, Art, in my speakership, that a very senior Conservative member of Parliament who had not voted for me came up to me and we had a most intriguing exchange. He was very hesitant that day, a very posh aristocratic man. And he said to me, Mr. Speaker, I didn't vote for you. I didn't vote for you. I didn't vote for you. And I thought, well, I knew that. I didn't have Sherlock Holmes to work that out. He said, I didn't vote for you. I voted for Sir George Young because I think he's a bloody good egg. Bloody good egg is a very sort of aristocratic British expression.
Yeah.
And he said, but can I say, Mr. Speaker, I think you're doing jolly well, if I may say so. I think you've made a jolly good start. You're absolutely excellent. All these urgent questions and dragging ministers to the chamber to answer and so on is absolutely right. Well done. Can I just make my point, he said to me. Uh-huh. I said, yes, please do make your point. And he said, Mr. Speaker, this, he was very hesitant. This outreach business of yours of visiting schools and hospitals and universities and so on. He said, I didn't get it. And I said, what do you mean you don't get it? He said he didn't understand it. And I said, I don't know quite what you don't understand. And he said, well, quite frankly, Mr. Speaker, he said, I think it's rather below stairs. Now, the expression below stairs is a very snobbish expression.
Yeah.
It means where the servants live in a big house. And he said, I think it's rather below stairs. Mr. Speaker, he said, can I say? He said, I think you occupy a very important office in this house as Speaker. And I think it's absolutely right. And we even give you a home in Speaker's house where you and your wife and family can live. It's absolutely right, where you can relax and so on when you've finished your duties in the chair. He said, but quite frankly, he said, I think that if people want to know what the Speaker does, Mr. Speaker, they should jolly well come to the gallery of the House of Commons, observe the Speaker at work. So the idea that you, sir, with your very high office, the idea that you should be trogging round the country, going to schools and drafty village halls and meetings of sort of the Women's Institute and so on, is absolutely ridiculous, he said, quite honestly.
Yeah.
I think it's rather below stairs, and he said, and it's beneath the dignity of the office.
Beneath
the dignity of the office. And I said, I completely disagreed. I said, I'm sorry, that's a very out-of-date view. And I said, I think I've got to get out there and talk to people and hear from people, engage with people. So that's what I did. Now, when you say, well, in the end, you know, wasn't the view of the British people crystallised in the form of the referendum?
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, I accept the result. I've already said that. It was a narrow victory. I think it was based on a false prospectus, and I think a lot of lies were told.
Okay, but do you also feel, in a way, do you also feel maybe a bit responsible, because critics have said that you have let the debate linger on for too long in the House of Commons, and that resulted in a Brexit fatigue, and that paved the way for the slogan, come on, get Brexit done.
Well, I don't myself feel responsible for that, because I feel responsible for the primary task of the Speaker, which is the facilitation art of the House. I know what you're saying. You know, isn't it the case that because it dragged on so long, people felt fatigue? And the answer to that is, yes, I think they did. And Boris Johnson very successfully campaigned in 2019's general election on that theme of get Brexit done. And he did play to the idea that Parliament was slowing things up.
Mm-hmm.
And delaying and obstructing and so on. And in the end, it's true that the public, I think, in large enough numbers at the election, felt, let's just get on with things. But my attitude was this. Yes, there had been a 2016 referendum, and that referendum said leave. But as Tony Blair at one point said in the debate, and he was a Labour person who said it, but there were Conservatives like Ken Clark and Michael Heseltine who said so as well, the country has voted for departure, but it hasn't voted for a destination. And what we needed to establish was, what did Brexit mean? Now, I don't know how many of your listeners know this, but although the referendum was in June 2016, it wasn't until July 2018, 2 years later, that the government actually produced a firm intent, came forward with a specific policy in what's called a government white paper, saying what Brexit would mean.
In other words, the
House of Commons had every right to vote on that.
Yeah.
Three times it rejected Theresa May's idea. And all I did was say, the House must have its say, and the House must have its way. So if you're saying, do I feel responsible for slowing the process up? No, I felt responsible for letting the House say what it wanted for as long as it wanted, as many times as it wanted, in deciding which course to chart.
Yeah.
So if you're saying, am I apologetic about the role I played? No.
No.
Of course, none of us is perfect. We're all flawed. Tahir is human.
Yeah.
If you ask me, do I have any fundamental regrets about my conduct?
The answer is no.
I absolutely don't.
Like you said at the top of the show, you also said there's absolutely nothing positive coming out of Brexit for the UK. We handled that as well. There was one other short question I would like to talk about, and that was the question, there's still a chance the UK will fall apart over Brexit. You said yes.
I hope it doesn't happen. I love my country. I would prefer the country to remain as one.
Mm-hmm.
I have never supported Scottish independence, but there is no doubt that there is very, very, very strong hostility in Scotland to Brexit and the Conservative government. And in legal terms, the government, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson, are perfectly entitled to say, we are not having another referendum on Scottish independence. We had one in 2014,
mm-hmm.
and the referendum by 55% to 45% was in favour of Scotland staying in the UK. However, as you will know, and your listeners will be aware, that referendum was before the Brexit referendum.
Mm-hmm.
And long before Brexit.
And now elections are coming on in May.
Now say the mood has changed.
Yeah.
And I suppose in a sense what I say is what you've got at the moment in terms of the relationship between Scotland and the UK government is the irresistible force meeting the immovable object. And this is a recipe for ongoing tension. The government can say you're not having another referendum and that's the end of it. But if the government keeps saying that, and if Scotland keeps saying, well, we want to look at this matter again,
mm-hmm.
something has to give at some point. I don't know how that will end, but you asked me the question, could Brexit still precipitate
lead
to the breakup of the UK?
Yeah.
I don't say it will, and I don't want it to do so, but it could. And there is also the question, of course, of the future of Northern Ireland.
Exactly.
Northern Ireland is very unhappy about Brexit,
mm-hmm.
and in the medium to long term, I think there is every possibility that there will be a united Ireland. That is to say, Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland coming together. And I don't say that that's going to happen soon, and I don't say it's certain to happen, but it could happen. And if it did happen, obviously it would involve a breakup of the United Kingdom. So I'm not predicting it. I'm not saying it's certain or even likely.
But you're saying there's still a chance.
It is a significant possibility. It is a significant possibility, yes.
Zometeen praat ik verder met voormalig speaker van het Britse Lagerhuis, John Bercow. Zometeen om 11 uur is er BNR breekt. Wat is vandaag je breekijzer?
BNR Nieuwsradio. The Big Five. Art Rooijakkers.
Je luistert naar BNR's Big Five van Brexit in perspectief. Met vandaag de gast John Bercow, voormalig speaker van het Britse Lagerhuis. Dus dit gesprek is in het Engels. Mr. Bercow, the last word has not yet been spoken about the trade deal between Europe and the UK. Will Boris Johnson be able to, well, get the best out of it, you think?
Well, he'll do his best.
Yeah, of course.
But I think it is very unlikely that he'll get a better deal for the UK than we enjoyed as members of the European Union. The European Union has got a perfectly natural and legitimate desire to protect itself
mm-hmm.
as an institution. And it logically follows from that that it is highly unlikely to offer Britain a better deal for walking away from the Union than it had when it was in the Union. And the truth of the matter, which I think wasn't very widely understood, even in the UK, is that the deal that we got was a minimal deal. It was a threadbare deal. It was a skeletal deal.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a framework. But huge numbers of matters in all sorts of spheres of trade and policy remain to be decided. There's much to be decided in relation to financial services and intellectual property and services more widely. And I find it hard to believe that we're going to get as good a deal as we had when we were part of the European Union. Because obviously, if countries were going to be able to get just as good a trade agreement with the Union without being subject to the governance of the Union,
mm-hmm.
well, that would trigger a breakup of the European Union. And I don't think the European Union wants that, and I don't think that's going to happen.
What
so, you know, we cannot exaggerate our own influence. We've got a right to our point of view, but in a negotiation, you have to take account of the views of the other side as well.
Yeah.
And when Brexiteers say, well, you know, the European Union's going to lose out because of the massive trade deficit the UK has? The answer is we are one market for EU countries. They've got lots of other markets with which to trade within the Union and beyond. As far as we're concerned, our capacity to sell our goods across the Union is going to be diminished. It is going to be undermined. It is going to be reduced. And the evidence of that is there for all to see already.
Yeah. What do you think? Is Boris Johnson the right man for the job at the moment? Because I was reading in your autobiography, Unspeakable, you were pretty negative about former Prime Minister Theresa May. Is Boris Johnson, will he do a better job, you think?
Well, he's a better campaigner than Theresa May. Theresa May campaigned appallingly badly in 2017 and ended up losing the Conservatives' majority. She wasn't able to campaign effectively. She didn't communicate well. Boris Johnson seems to communicate rather better with the electorate, and it has to be acknowledged that he won a big majority. That is something that will help him. Obviously, if a government doesn't have an overall majority, it's quite difficult for it to make any sort of progress. He has a majority of 80+. So I think that he's going to be able to do quite a lot of domestic things without all that much trouble or difficulty. Whether, however, in relation to the great matter of European policy and trade deals he will be successful is, I think, very uncertain. I repeat, I can't see him getting a better deal than we would have had in the European Union. I think he's a more skillful politician than Theresa May. And, you know, he is going to be the Prime Minister for the foreseeable future. Occasionally there's speculation that he might leave office or be forced out of office. I don't myself see that happening anytime soon. He's got a big majority.
Yeah.
And so I sometimes think people predict that because they want that to happen. Yeah, if you ask me honestly, trying to be as fair-minded and impartial and observer as I can be, do I think Boris Johnson will cease to be Prime Minister in the next 6 months or 12 months? No, I think that's unlikely. As things stand, I think he'll probably fight the next election in 2023. And I very much doubt he'd serve a full term after that. I think sometime after that, sometime between 2023 and 2027-8, I dare say he would stand down. But I mean, I think he's with us for the time being. He has some skills as a politician. He has a certain populist touch. I don't like the import of parts of the Trump playbook by this government. I don't like the neglect of Parliament and the disrespect for the courts and the what I regard as rather cheap Pujadist populism of the government. But he is the Prime Minister, and no doubt he will continue. He has a certain sort of wit.
Yeah.
Is he a natural public speaker? No, he's not a natural public speaker at all. No, he is very hesitant in debate and so on.
Yeah.
But at the moment, he's the most powerful figure in British politics, and I expect that will remain so for some time to come.
Yeah, now we're looking into the future. If we do that, will we see you back in politics again?
I think that's very unlikely.
No?
Okay. There is a general expectation that the Speaker departs the stage
and then that's
and
it.
Doesn't get involved in politics again. I think there's an old expression, never say never. If you ask me, do I have plans to return to party politics, I have no such plans. And obviously, once you've stepped down from the House of Commons, you wouldn't intend to go back to the House of Commons. So I'm spending my time doing a lot of public speaking. I am a non-executive director of a sports business. I'm a professor of politics at London University. I'm chancellor of my old university, the University of Essex. I've got various charitable interests, and I love football and I love tennis. So I have more time for watching football. I'd like to watch football live again soon, and more time to watch tennis and play tennis and to have perhaps, Art, if you like, a different work-life balance. Doing the job of Speaker, holding that office, was the greatest privilege of my professional life, and I thanked my colleagues then, and I reiterate my thanks now. They did me an enormous honour in electing me Speaker and then re-electing and re-electing and re-electing me. I'll never do anything quite like that role, but all good things come to an end, and I decided in 2017 and said to my wife that I wouldn't fight another election.
Yeah.
And I originally thought of going, calling it a day, in 2018, and then because of the Brexit process, I stayed on a bit longer. But I didn't want to go on indefinitely, because I think that eventually you should hand over to someone else with fresh ideas and energy and have a change of course in your life. And it's better to go when people say, why is he going? Than to wait until everybody says, oh,
why isn't he leaving?
Go. Yeah.
So what's, you mentioned tennis. What's true about the story that you played against Boris Johnson and defeated him 6-0, 6-0, 6-0?
True.
True. Okay. Well,
this is correct.
Okay.
Played at his country house when he was foreign secretary on the court there. He was, to be fair, a very good loser.
Uh-huh.
He wasn't bad-tempered or unsporting. He did try to use, I had brought some good balls to use, Art, and I can tell your listeners, on this moss-infected court, there were a few very, very, very old balls secreted away at the sides of the court, which had no fur on them. Uh-huh. And he sometimes picked those out and tried to surprise me by using them. So that was rather a cheeky way to behave, a piece of Johnsonian gamesmanship, if I may say so. Yeah. But it was ineffective in that I did indeed win the match, 6-love, 6-love, 6-love. Yeah. And then afterwards, we had a very pleasant lunch inside.
Okay.
So it was a fun experience. But I think I would say, in all courtesy and politeness towards the Prime Minister, that he's better at politics than he is at tennis.
Yeah. We're still trying to, well, foresee the future in a way. If we look at Brexit again, Brexit has been done. The UK is separate from the EU now. But will this be forever, you think? Or do you think the UK will ever return to the European Union somewhere in the near future?
I think it's quite possible. I don't think... Did you say the near future?
Yeah, well, not the near future, the next coming years, but say in the next coming decades.
I think it's possible in the next 10 to 15 years that the UK might return. I don't think it's remotely on the agenda at the moment. I don't think it's discussed. I don't think it's talked about. I don't think it's seriously planned. I think that there is a general sense that the people have spoken and the government has a large majority and Brexit has happened, or at least the first phase of Brexit has happened. And we've got in that rather unfussy, quiet, pragmatic British way to make the best of it and try to forge a constructive path for the UK and the markets and councils of the world. But is it forever? I don't think in a democracy you can say anything is forever.
Mm-hmm.
People have a right to change their minds, and the UK could at some point decide that it wanted to go back into the European Union. I think that's perfectly possible. But is it going to happen in the next 5 years? No. Is it likely in the next 10? I think unlikely, but I think it is possible in the next 10 and certainly in the next 15 years or so, I can imagine that it might happen. I think we've got to wait to see.
Yeah, that's the only thing to do. What's the most worrisome thing in the near future if you look at Brexit?
Diminished trade and joblessness. Mm. The pandemic has bred huge economic dislocation. We've lost about £250 billion consequent upon the pandemic. So there was going to be terrible damage to our economy and greater indebtedness and an increase in the number of people losing their jobs. In any case, my anxiety, my worry, my sadness, Art, about Brexit is that I feel that it's going to hit most those who have least.
Yeah.
That is the tragedy of Brexit. If you are someone who my late father would have described as having a lot of wool on your back, that is to say being prosperous, well, then it probably won't do you any great harm. I think if you're super talented or very wealthy highly qualified, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
I think the people who are going to struggle are those who've got the least qualifications, who are in low-paid work, and a lot of them are going to struggle. And I think that's a great pity. And it is an irony that there were parts of the country where people voted for Brexit.
Exactly.
Apparently didn't realise that they were going to be hard hit by it.
Yeah.
In the immediate term, today and this week, the issue on very large numbers of voters' minds is not even Brexit. The issue on a lot of voters' minds, because we're a nation of football fans,
is the Super League.
Is the
I wanted to talk to you about that
terrific European Super League.
Yeah, I did want to talk to you about that, but unfortunately, our time is up. The next show will start here in a couple of minutes. So I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Mr. Speaker John Bercow. Thank you for your time in joining us from the UK. I want to talk to our listeners, want alle afleveringen van BNR's Big Five zijn natuurlijk terug te luisteren.
luisteren. De podcast is te vinden in de BNR-app en op bnr.nl. Nu op deze zender BNR.
Bij BNR ben je altijd als eerste op de hoogte van het laatste nieuws. Luister dagelijks live via internet. Bas van Werven.
En heel langzaam komt de zon op rond dit tijdstip. Je krijgt inzicht in de dag die komt op BNR, het Binnenhof in Nederland en de rest van de wereld.
De ochtendspits.
Voor de beste start van je werkdag.
Blijf scherp en mis niets.